You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
On the Breakfast Grill today is AirAsia Rex CEO Benjamin Ismail, who joined AirAsia Rex in 2015. Welcome to the show. I think AirAsia Rex needs no introduction. So welcome again and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Julian.
Now, let's address that big elephant in the room, right? That competition with Malaysia Airlines. And when I interviewed Crystal Muller, the ex-CEO of Malaysia Airlines, he refused to pigeonhole Malaysia Airlines into either a full-service carrier or a budget airline. But, you know, they're selling a lot of cheap tickets and also at the same time selling the business class as well. What do you think is this competitive landscape with Malaysia Airlines?
The good thing about the competition landscape with Malaysian Airlines is it has improved. When we came in, I guess, 2 years ago, the competition landscape was really, really, really bad. I think we saw Malaysian Airlines really dumping its fares. And I guess that led to us as well losing quite a lot of money. Because I think for AsiaRex, we can't be, as a low-cost carrier, you can't be seen selling tickets much cheaper than a full-service carrier. So we had to follow suit with the pricing. So
how is it that they are able to sell cheaper than a budget carrier?
Well, I think that's something that's a decision-making at the top, because I think one of it was, it went through a bit of a cycle in terms of brand impact, I think, as you know, with the air crashes. From what I hear, the load factors were pretty down, and they really needed to fill the planes. And I think they, through the ASEAN and also North Asia markets, the pricing was very, very, very low. Australia as well. I think Australia, as you know, is very sensitive to any news.
Am I reading it wrongly? Because the price competition seems a lot more perennial than that those one or two major scandals suggest.
No, I think it's linked to that. Because I think, you know, for any airline, I think, you know, the main goal is to make sure you fill that aircraft at all cost. You know, and I think, you know, I think they were going through that stage where they weren't filling it up. And I think the good thing about the whole thing is when Christoph came in, brought a bit of stability. He invested in the brand. He invested in making sure that he cut costs. And it was about the right timing. I think the fares went up. And that also gave us the ability for us as well to move our fares up in the market.
Now, if I look at some of the latest figures from the fourth quarter of 2016, the average fares in the fourth quarter for Malaysian Airlines Berhad, 484 ringgit, and AirAsia Rex, 565 ringgit. Now, if my numbers are correct, I mean, the MH, we just went through the third anniversary of it. This is pretty recent. So these numbers suggest very intense competition.
Well, I think, first of all, you've got to realize that as well, that they only have, if you would think that if for a full-service carrier, they have more long-haul routes. At the moment, they only have London on there. So really, their market has always been regional in Australia and North Asia, which is our markets. But I think the good thing is, this fares, I think, is an improvement for where it was in the past. You know, as you see ours as well, in the last four quarters, we've seen consistent growth at about 30%. And I think the market is slow. As I said earlier, I think the market is improving and the demand is improving as well.
But how do you explain that? Because you're a budget airline and yet a supposedly hybrid airline like Malaysia Airlines can sell tickets at average prices that are lower than AirAsia Rex.
Well, for us, I think at the end of the day, it's the brand. For me, I mean, my focus is to ensure that my loads are consistently above 80%. And when we dynamic priced, we will not, we will open fares at a very low brackets, but when it fills up, we'll move that fares up. So I think for us, as you see, consistently we've been about in the 81, 82%, and that's good for us. As long as we can sell the higher brackets of fares, I'm happy. You know, I think.
And we always hear in the past that Tony Fernandez railing against Malaysian Airlines as well. And that was in the past, right, where Malaysian Airlines, owned by Khazanah, had a little bit of a helping hand from the government. Is that still, in your eyes, happening? And is that considered a kind of competitive advantage on the part of Malaysia Airlines?
Well, you can't take it away, you know, in the fact that they are wholly owned by, you know, Khazanah. I mean, for us, I think AsiaRex itself, I think, I mean, the positive side of things is we've been able to raise cash on our own and really grow based on our cash bank. And that's my focus, really. I think, you know, we just have to make sure that we're every pound foolish on every spending we do. And I think that we've done that from the 2 years that I came in when our cash was pretty much at the bare minimum. We've built it up to more about 400 million ringgit in cash now, which is good. And I think our focus in the next 1 or 2 years is to build that mall to at least, you know, 700 or 800 million, and that's our focus.
There was also, I mean, I got to make clear that we are not interviewing you as a strategist for Malaysian Airlines, right? But there was also a few things that Malaysian Airlines did that seemed strategically correct, like having that code share with Emirates and going with One World Alliance, which expanded their route a lot more and at the same time allowed them to sort of regroup and ease their gearing levels a little bit by not buying too many planes. From a budget airline philosophy, how are you reacting to these kinds of development? I mean, are you going to start something of a code share of yourself? Is that relevant?
No, I think to me, I see it in a different way, and I think they're reacting to our alliances. I mean, our alliances in terms of Asia Rex is our alliance with short-haul AirAsia. As you see, they have close to about 120 aircraft in KL, and we also have other AOCs coming in from Thailand, from Indonesia, and really feed into our network. If you see the stats, about 45% of our traffic actually comes from short-haul, and likewise, we feed the same amount of numbers to short-haul. And that's an alliance to us, you know. And again, you know, if there are any other ASEAN's AOCs that do pop up on the short-haul side, that will feed us too. So I think that's our strategy moving forward. Keep it within in-house.
We're speaking with Benjamin Ismail, who's the CEO of AirAsia Rex. Ben, you spoke about this idea of short-haul, but recently it was announced that AirAsia Rex would fly to Maui in the United States, and that's very long-haul. How does this sit in with this short-haul versus long-haul strategy?
Well, actually, it's actually a sweet spot for us because our average flying time is about 7 to 8 hours, and that's really about it for Hawaii as well because we do a one-stop in Osaka. So Osaka is about 6.5 hours, and it takes another 6.5 hours to 7 hours to Hawaii. And really, I think that target market for us is really the Japanese. We know that Hawaii is the number one destination for Japanese. And just looking at the sales, that just explains it. I mean, 80% of our flights going in there are from Japan, and it's doing
really
well.
Will Malaysians be able to get on this trip as well?
There is. I mean, we were not expecting a lot of people from Malaysia or ASEAN to go on these flights. We were looking at about a single-digit number, and actually we've seen about 10% growth, 10% of the flights coming from this side of the world. And what surprised me the most is there were people coming from Indonesia, Thailand, doing a two-stop. They go Bangkok, Kuala Lumpur, Osaka, Osaka, Hawaii, and we've seen that.
So would you say that that's kind of synergistic because you're making use of every of those destinations? I mean, those transits can become destinations in themselves.
Exactly. I think this is our second go at it. The first one we had was we're doing Kuala Lumpur, Gold Coast, Auckland. And that one's the same strategy as well. And Gold Coast to Auckland, that New Zealand finds Gold Coast as a weekend getaway for them. And that load has been close to about 85%, and that's doing really well for us. And it's just the same strategy we're doing on this side.
You know, I'm just curious, as you put those bums on seats, right, what is the comfort level? Because we're talking about a Malaysian traveling from KL to Osaka and then on travel to Hawaii. I mean, how much pain can they take in that budget airline? What are you doing to ease the comfort? I mean, I've flown Ryanair before, and I tell you, it's no walk in the park. They really make you suffer for cheap pricing. Are you going that direction?
No, I think, I mean, I have to say that our seats are quite comfortable. I mean, there are always people that are happy to sit in economy. I think our pitch is pretty much similar. So I think we have a bit more leg space. I mean, for you as well, Julian, if you want an upgrade to flatbed, we have that too. We have 12 seats available as well.
And how much is that? How much that cost?
You're looking at about at least, you know, 2 times more than economy, which is probably looking at 3 or 4 times cheaper than a business class or full service. But the reality is, I think you've seen the markets now. People are becoming very price sensitive in travel. You've seen the habits of spending has changed as well. People are willing to sacrifice flying, the mode of flying, because, you know, and rather spend at the Four Seasons on destination and shop more.
So experiential.
Exactly. And people now, if you see, they're traveling now with everybody. And low cost, you've seen that. In full service, you potentially just fly with your wife. In low cost carousel, and us, you bring your family, your kids. And now you see now the trends, they bring their mates too. So that affordability allows, you know, consumers or, well, I can say passengers to do that now. The ability to do that.
Do you offer more in terms of entertaining to ease some of these long flights as well? And that has some bearings on the budget philosophy, right?
I mean, I think the two things that you'll notice when you fly us is really, I think, I would say about 50% of people are now very self-sustaining, which means that they bring their own iPads, they bring their own laptops, and they watch their own movies. But doesn't mean that we don't offer anything. Well, we do offer onboard tablets, which you can pre-book or get on board, which has close to about 20 movies We have music, we have games. We're now in the midst of trying to put Wi-Fi on board. That's probably something that is probably towards the second half of the year. And that's going to be something that is great. But I think at the end of the day, I think, you know, people generally just bring their own things and they're happier than that.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you add all this together, because I know that what is called the ancillary income, right, is a big portion of the AirAsia Group's earnings. So when you add in the rented iPads and the food that you need for this long-haul flight, will it become more expensive?
No, not really. Yeah. It depends on what you spend. You know, I think if you generally, if you spend this bare minimum in terms of 20 kilos, buy one nasi lemak, one drink, you have more than enough in terms of pricing. I think there are people who do go crazy and spend 10 nasi lemaks and you know, and order drinks on board and whichever. I think I can't shy away that I have to say that AirAsia do offer good food, you know, and you know, I think for AsiaRex as well, we cater for the demography of people. I mean, the Australians, we offer pies. In Japan, we offer bentos, et cetera, right? So I think the onboard sales for us is you're looking at spending at about $120 per person per flight, which is good compared to your short haul, because short haul is a bit shorter. But I think for us is we want to make sure that we offer everything on board to give that option and the option to pre-book at a cheaper price. That's what we do.
We're speaking with Benjamin Ismail, CEO of AirAsiaRex, and coming up next, we'll talk about some of the pressing issues in the global market, including oil and debt levels. This morning on The Breakfast Grill, we have Benjamin Ismail, CEO of AirAsiaRex. Now, Benjamin, AirAsiaRex is ordering quite a lot of this A330neo planes that is expected to improve on fuel savings to the extent of 14% per seat. And this is crucial in helping you deal with the oil environment.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I think currently the oil environment is pretty stable. I mean, we're happy. And ideally, we want it lower, which it was there before. But I think, you know, this helps us in terms of pricing our tickets. That's important. But as well, I mean, the strategy for us as well is to hedge some of our positions up ahead, especially at this price. Last year, we were, in the first time, I think in many years, we hedged 100% 6 months out. This time, we're about 76% hedged for this year at about $60 per barrel. And I think that's a good sign. And I think in terms of the fuel prices, I think this is about the levels that will continue to go. As you know, the supply of oil is out there. It's still quite massive. I don't think the price will move that much. So I think we're quite comfortable. The aircraft does help for us a bit. So we can't wait. I think the first aircraft of the 330neos come in into the system probably towards the end of next year. And that's going to be a groundbreaker for us.
Are you going to fully retire the A330-300s with these neos?
No, not really. I think it goes in with our replacement schedules. Usually we'll look at, you know, a typical aircraft that is with us is about, we will do a lease for about 12 years, and that's when it goes for its biggest check. And once it goes for its biggest checks, we'll return those aircrafts, and then we'll replace it with the neos. And that's what it is. I think the first replacement of our aircraft, we're looking at probably at about 2021. Our fleet's pretty young. Our average age is about 5 years. So we've still got a long way to go.
And the range in terms of kilometres for the neos, just a little bit over 12,000 kilometres.
Yep.
But you're saying that you're breaking up the flight because Osaka to Hawaii is just 7,000.
Correct.
But that whole journey from KL to Hawaii, if one wants to take that, that's almost 11,000. And if you went to San Francisco, for example, I don't know whether you're expanding your route over there, that's about 14,000 kilometres.
Well, the NEOs is really for regional flying and really make it more fuel efficient for us and do, I guess, more rotations or more sectors within a day. But I think our strategy is to focus on that. There will be one or two routes that potentially that we will use the aircraft for long haul for branding purposes. I think Tony as well has mentioned quite verbally in the markets that he wants to go back to London. We also have to assess whether the Israeli 330neos can go there.
Mm-hmm. And Paris?
And Paris. But I think, you know, we also want to identify new markets. I mean, that's what we're good at. Markets that we know that are underserved from Asia. So we are looking at all kinds of destinations. Hawaii is a great example that we used. It's very underserved in Asia. And if we can find a destination in Europe that potentially is similar, we'll do it. I think we want to be first there.
And the U.S. is a huge market as well. I mean, there's not only Hawaii, but there's San Francisco, there is New York, there's Vegas. How do you strategize as to how you're going to expand the U.S. routes?
Well, I think the good first thing is to see Hawaii as a stepping stone. We got our FAA approval. That was important. And really, I think if you want to do L.A. or San Francisco or Las Vegas from Japan, With the 330 NEOs, it's difficult. I think as you're looking at about a 12-hour, 13-hour flight, which is a stretch for our 330. We may have to look at a different model of aircraft. As you know, we have on order a 350, which is probably more many years to come. But if that's still in the plans, we can use that to fly that with no issues. From Japan, we can use that as a platform for us.
Will you at any point have a strategy to take that quantum leap to go beyond that 7,000 kilometers radius? Does that make sense from an economics viewpoint?
Like you said, I mean, I think one of the key things is comfort. I think low cost is, like I mentioned, the sweet spot, the most comfort level for us is looking at 7-8 hours travel. Mm-hmm. And I think if sitting down on a tight seat for 14 hours may be a bit of a stretch, but I think if we were doing that, we may have to relook at the configurations of the aircraft to give more bit of room and see whether we can make enough revenue to cover the seat cost. That's important for us.
Just going back to the oil outlook, I mean, fine, you're hedging currently, at the latest number, 70, almost 3/4% of your jet fuel requirements. The question is, why not 100%?
Why not 100%? We are heading towards that. Okay. We of course, we are dealing with financial institutions. So we have to make sure that we get the right pricing. So there are orders. The good thing about this is we hedge as a group. Mm-hmm. We don't hedge solely. I think the 76% as well is entire, also in short haul.
So you get group discounts.
Yeah, we get group discounts. Yeah. So we go that aggressively. So really, that's driven on the regional side. So we just follow. And we also make sure that we are in line with our forward bookings. We can block in our costs, our fares. And that's really what we're doing. So I think ideally your question is, if we can get 100%, it would be great. But we would rather to have 100% more at a lower price and see. We are just monitoring where the pricing is going at the moment.
It seems like there are so many moving parts as well, because the fuel consideration cannot be isolated from the ringgit, which has done very poorly in the past year. How do you put it all together, and how is this affecting demand?
Well, the good thing is, we haven't had a position where, we had a position where the ringgit and the US and the fuel was very up 2 years ago. But now we've seen fuel drop considerably and kind of like nets off against the currency. But the good thing as well is, in terms of our revenues that we receive, sales from markets, predominantly, our ringgit receipts are probably about 40%. But to take away as well, we do have close to 20% from Australia, which is a big generator for us. We also have a lot of US dollars, probably about 14%. Those are because of sales that we get from China, because it gets settled in US dollars to us. So really, I think, that kind of helps us in terms of our cash flow and also netting off all our costs, which are in US dollars. So all in all, it's okay. I think, we just have to be wary that the currency doesn't move even further out. So we just have to be wary with that moving forward.
And in your quest to optimize your global route strategy, I'm sure the two biggest associates are very important in that consideration, Thai AirAsia and Indonesia AirAsia. And they have been making a pretty big losses. So how do you manage this, especially when there is also Japan, India, and the United States as well? Will this going forward result in a lot more losses coming from all these associates?
Well, I think the good thing about these two markets is, let's take Thailand, for example. I think the losses for both are very minimal. I mean, there are losses. I mean, we agree. But I think for TAAX, I think they've been unfortunate because Thailand has been downgraded from Category 1 to Category 2. So all their growth has been slowed down because of approvals. But the good thing is, on the current routes that they fly to Japan, to China, and to Korea, it's doing very, very well. Loads are higher than us. They are looking at about 89% loads, 90% on average, and they fill it up. But now they're now just looking at some countries that they can fly to Europe. I think they're in the midst of just getting approvals for that. And I think in terms of the owings, that's decreasing as we move on. The other associate is Indonesia. I think they had some issues in terms of, regulatory issues in the past. I think the ministry was trying to merge the two entities together, the short haul and the long haul. So, but now with the new ministry there, Ministry of Transport, they are open to IAX to operate on itself. And the good thing about Indonesia is it's been upgraded from Cat 2 to Cat 1 after many, many years. And now they have the whole world to fly to. So I think they have quite a very aggressive business plan coming up. They're looking at a June start. There's some markets that they're looking at flying from Bali, and this is going to be a great market for them. And I think that will be a starting point for them.
You've suspended the Bali operations,
We have,
right?
So, but they're going to restart again. And the base will be in Bali still. So, mm-hmm. And I think I'm very optimistic that they're going to do very well.
Mm-hmm. There was this also other thing about the UK's serious fraud office charged Rolls-Royce on corrupt practices recently. And Rolls-Royce had to pay about £600 million in penalty. And the dealings between Rolls-Royce and AirAsia Rex were among the charges. And Rolls-Royce had to pay AAX-related penalties of 94 million ringgit to the UK government. So, did this happen? Did any of the staff get a go-ahead to engage in corrupt practices or bribes?
No, I mean, that's something that I guess we've engaged lawyers as well to investigate these issues. Mm-hmm. We've denied any of those reports. You know, I think the key thing as well is...
This is the UK government naming... Prosecuting Rolls-Royce, but naming AirAsia Rex in the process.
Basically, they were naming us having a relationship with Caterham Jets. And really, I think the key important message that we've also published to Bursa is... We do have a relationship with Caterham Jet. We do pay them management fees every month in terms of the upkeep of the jet there. And AirAsia does the same as well. So we've disclosed that actually from day one when we IPO'd. We did that in the rights issues. And we do every year Bruce AGM announcement on this. So really for us, I think there's on our side, we're quite clear. I think we just told Rolls-Royce to give us a full report of the investigation when they are done. Mm-hmm. But I think in terms of that, I think we strongly denied any of those claims in there.
Okay, what they actually put in charge sheet was that the AirAsia Group employee received some kickbacks in the form of a maintenance credit for the private jets. Is this a normal industry practice that you get discounts in the form of a maintenance credit?
No, I mean, I think we do get credits, but I think, you know, that credits was more towards the use of AirAsia Rex. But, you know, I think this is the relationship that we have with Rolls-Royce. But in terms of that being used for other purposes, now that's something that we strongly deny. And pretty much that's it.
And what kind of steps have you taken since that case to ensure that internally everything is done above board?
No, I mean, basically... Everything's done above board, as you know. We published it on at the AGM. We've gone to the IPO prospectus. All this has been brought up to the board, and really, it's the same. You know, we will continue to do that and keep the board abreast of all our doings. Mm-hmm.
What do you think of the entire Malaysian corporate scene? Right, what is your feel of the kind of corporate governance level, the quality of corporate governance within the Malaysian corporate sector? I mean, for the longest time, the AirAsia Group has had to deal with Malaysian Airlines, which was which still is a GLC. So,
well, I mean, I can't comment on how the other corporates, you know, in terms of corporate governance, but I think, you know, in terms of us, we do have very strong. Spread of board members who come from all kinds of industries, especially on the AirAsia Rex side. We have Tan Sri Rafida, we have Tan Sri Asmat, you know, we have Dato' Yusli from the Bursa. All these guys are industry experts, you know, and I think the key thing is really, you know, the corporate governance that they've implied to us to make sure that we do that and an example to the public. And I think I can't say much more other than the fact that I think we have a pretty good set of board of directors on our company.
Just as a final question, Ben, you, I'm sure, work a lot with Tony Fernandez. What is it like, can you tell us, working with him?
Well, I think the difference is, as you know, he's an entrepreneur. It's not easy. I think, you know, everything that he wants is yesterday. But I think the good thing about it is he's dynamic. You know, he sees things that we all don't. And really, and the good thing is it's infectious, right? You know, you can see something that it's nothing, and he can actually sell it to you and say, you know, it's a gold mine. And the worst thing is he's actually correct. You know, he can sell a route where you think that it's only 100,000 people that goes, you know, in that population, and you can make that route into a gold mine. A great example is Busan, you know, Busan, Korea, where you can never expect it will fly there. And now we fly five times a week. We're loaded at about 88%. Mm-hmm. We're doing really well. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of visions he saw, which I didn't see. Mm-hmm. And it's infectious. You know, I hate to say it. You know, he is right sometimes. So, you know.
Sometimes. Thank you so much for joining us. And that was Benjamin Ismail, CEO of AirAsia Rex on this morning's Breakfast Grill. I'm Julian Ng, BFM 89.9.
Thanks, Julian.
That episode of BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by U-Mobile, where data hearts you.